Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And folks, it is time to ask the doctors. Lots of mixed signals in this particular COVID moment as we head into a weekend that is traditionally full of people gathering. On Wednesday, the state reported a little more than 3,000 new cases, but it does look like we might be on a bit of a downswing. Everywhere you turn, someone seems to have COVID. But how long will that help protect them from getting it again? And then there's Paxlovid and increasing worries that it could make you better, only to maybe make things worse. Listen, we long for the day when we will not have so many questions, but it is not this day. So we have two doctors with us to help answer some. Dr. Lou Ann Bruno-Murtha from Cambridge Health Alliance is the chief of their infectious disease division, and Dr. Simone Wilds, an infectious disease physician at South Shore Health. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Dr. Bruno-Murtha, I'll start with you. We have seen a slight downtick in the number of cases as of the 25th, though. I'm thinking about vaccines. Nearly 5.4 million people in the state say they were fully vaccinated. That's the initial vaccination course. Only 3 million were boosted. And we are seeing still a lot of infections from these new variants. So when you put all those pieces together, where are we? How do you feel we're doing? Are you sort of in a yellow worry, a red, oh my God, a green, chill out, it's going to be okay? How are you thinking about it?
Yes, thanks for the question. I am taking some reassurance from looking at the wastewater data. And over the past couple of days, it is going down. It's in line with what we're seeing with daily cases in the state. Now, of course, the daily case number, we have to be cautious about putting too much faith in that number, because home tests, which are largely used by many of us, are not being included in that. So I think we're looking at a point where things are going to start looking better once again. But I do think we still need to encourage anyone who has not been boosted to go out and get your booster. It will help prevent more severe disease if you do have an infection. And we are certainly seeing much less in the way of hospitalizations and severe diseases right at the present time.
So I do want to stay with that for a second, Dr. Bruno-Murtha, with you, because you talked about hospitalization, you talked about deaths. Are we at a point where there is a de-linking between sort of case counts, positivity rates, and death rates with these variants of COVID?
Yeah, I definitely see that with the current Omicron, and now we have a new variant that really has a foothold in the entire country, the Omicron BA.2.12.1. And with this particular variant, although, again, it may be more contagious, and that's why we're seeing and hearing about a lot of friends and family members who have COVID. Fortunately, their disease is mild, and they are staying out of the hospital, and they're not requiring critical care. Now, we are still seeing hospitalizations largely among individuals that are not up to date with their vaccine. So I would urge everyone who is not up to date, meaning they need to have had that booster dose, to go out and plan to get that dose.
So I want to pick up Dr. Simone Wilds first on what Dr. Bruno-Murtha just said about milder infection. We're talking about the new variant, the BA. I just call it 12. I know that's not, but there's like 17 dots there. And I don't mean to make light of it. I am relieved to hear that they're milder infections. But we do have a question from a member of our texting club, AJ from Quincy, who asked, what are doctors hearing from patients about this wave of COVID? I was quite sick in spite of being vaccinated and boosted. I know some others who were infected around the same time as me, and their symptoms are bad too. Is this wave of COVID infections producing more pronounced symptoms? So let's just take that head on.
So Tiziana, thanks again for having me. What I am seeing right now for the patients that have been vaccinated and boosted is that their symptoms are really mild. You know, they have body aches, they have the fevers, last for a few days, and then they recover. For the patients that haven't been vaccinated, their symptoms are by far more severe. Some of them have been in the hospital. Some of those individuals we have actually treated with Paxlovid, but in general, milder with this new subvariant.
And Dr. Wild, staying with you on this for a second, I have heard a number of people wonder, should they, do they need to know, does it matter to know what COVID they had? For example, Delta versus Omicron over the winter holidays, which variant of Omicron now? I'm sure at a research level that's important, but is it important for someone to know which COVID they had?
Absolutely not. I think if you have COVID, you know, we recommend that you isolate, you do all the things we've been talking about from the start of the pandemic. But to really identify the particular variant that you have at this point, that's not going to be relevant. I mean, right now, if you have COVID, you're going to have the Omicron subvariant more than likely, and we're not going to worry whether or not you have the Delta variant because you don't have much protection from having the prior variant.
At this point, how are we tracking that, Dr. Bruno Murtha? You pointed out a minute ago that with so many people testing at home, that information goes to them, the test goes in the trash, there's never that next step. So how are we able to track this, and are you confident that we know what's going on with the amount of testing sort of officially being done and tracked?
Yes, there is testing being performed by a number of academic medical centers that have partnered with CDC, and this information is available on the CDC website looking at the circulating variants. And even though there's a lot of home testing, there are still many PCR tests that are done. And some of those samples are then sent to these research labs and undergo sequencing. And that's how they continue to monitor the variants that are present in different geographic locations. And I'm confident that that information is reliable. And I think we could, take that information and value it and continue to keep an eye on new emerging variants. You may have heard in South Africa, there's BA4, BA5, and that information is important for us to monitor here and really throughout the world. So I think we could feel comfortable that people are watching that information closely.
And Dr. Simone Wilds, forgive me for this sort of non-medical question, but in reaction to what we just heard Dr. Bruno Murtha say, new variants we're hearing about in South Africa, how should we feel about that, right? I mean, you hear that and there's some instinct to sort of curl up in a fetal position somewhere and give up. And if that's not the case anymore, if that's data that we can all look at as good to know, but I don't have to be scared. That seems important. How should we feel about that?
One of the things that we've been talking about since this pandemic start is that, you know, we're going to see a lot of variants, and we have seen that come to fruition with the many different variants that we have gone through. And so hearing about new variants, I don't think we should really be alarmed because we expect that. Another reason we should not be alarmed is that we have a lot more tools now in order to treat patients with COVID. The most important one, of course, is vaccines and boosters, but we also have drugs that we can use to help patients that do get COVID. So I think, you know, when you hear about the variants, I would say don't be alarmed. Just make sure if you do get COVID and you're high risk or you have concerns, you contact your healthcare provider so you can figure out whether or not you need to get some treatment.
So this is Ask the Doctors on Radio Boston. We're speaking with Dr. Simone Wilds of South Shore Health and Dr. Luann Bruno Murtha of Cambridge Health Alliance. And Dr. Bruno Murtha, I want to pick up on the two themes Dr. Wilds just sounded, right? The first was vaccines and boosters, and the second one was treatment. So let's start with vaccines and boosters. You reminded everybody, if you have not been boosted with that first booster, do it. How long, based on what we know now, because this changes, as I understand it, a lot over time, how long does a booster actually last? How long is it protective?
Yeah, so based on a lot of the information that's become available recently, we know that a booster will provide good levels of antibodies for at least 4 months. And then after 4 months, they do start to decline. And that really was the basis for some changes with the boosting schedule. So as you may know, that all adults 50 years of age and older are now eligible to get a second booster, so that if they are beyond 4 months, they can actually boost their immunity to COVID. So it's more important, I think, for individuals that are older than 50 who have comorbidities and other risk factors for progression. And certainly we know for immunocompromised patients, it is critically important. Their primary series actually is 3 doses. And then they are eligible for 2 additional booster doses. So immunocompromised immunocompromised patients can get up to 5 vaccines at this point in time.
So I'm mindful that I'm also thinking, Dr. Wildes, I get that it's not even Memorial Day yet, but eventually winter is coming. And I know there are those who wonder, if it only lasts 4 months and I qualify now, should I wait? Or is it likely that there will be a booster again in the fall? And in fact, is it likely that we live on a 4-month booster cycle now?
You know, to be honest, some of those questions, we don't have all the answers, but I will say that there's a very high possibility that we're going to need another booster in the winter. And so, you know, I tell my patients, if you're eligible for a booster now, go ahead and get the booster. When it comes around to the fall, we will talk about another booster. You know, the goal is to try to keep everyone healthy and safe, keep everyone out of the hospitals, prevent severe illness and death. And so if we need to get another booster now and in the fall, I think that's what we'll recommend.
So Dr. Bruno Murtha, Dr. Wildes said a minute ago, we need to be aware, but we can be calm as new variants come because of the vaccine courses that we have and also the treatments. And that's where I want to go next, is Paxlovid and the increasing stories that we are hearing and now some data. And I want to be thoughtful about this. I don't want to overshoot something that shouldn't be overshot on the air. But I want to be thoughtful about asking, where are we on our level of understanding of whether Paxlovid causes this rebound effect where you get better, but then you get sick again, and maybe you thought you were better, so perhaps you have then behaviors that make you more infectious to someone else, you know, that whole kind of messy bundle. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, the Paxlovid rebound is really an evolving area, and we don't actually know the frequency of it in the clinical trial of Paxlovid compared to placebo. It wasn't about 1 or 2% of cases in both the study arms, so the patients that had the Paxlovid and the patients who had COVID and received no treatment. So we know it's part of just the viral infection to some degree. We don't actually know how frequent it is in individuals who take Paxlovid. However, clearly it's been well documented. There's published reports now. And when a patient has a rebound, in general, it's milder and it's of shorter duration. But we do know that those individuals can again be infectious. So they have to again isolate for 5 days. But fortunately, it's a short-term relapse. And it doesn't happen in everyone.
But it does restart the clock if it happens. It restarts the clock on sort of what happens in your life and what you're responsible for doing if you rebound, correct?
That is correct. That is correct. So really, the decision to take Paxlovid is a decision between the patient and their provider, and it's a risk-benefit assessment. And if that patient has risk factors for severe disease, that certainly weighs the balance a little bit more to taking Paxlovid. If you don't have risk factors for progression, you may make a decision with your provider not to take Paxlovid because you don't want to run the risk of having to go back into isolation for 5 days.
All right, thank you. Dr. Simone Wildes, I'm going to pick up another question from several people in our texting group had variations on the question. If a person had COVID, how long does it take for them to be at risk for getting it again? How long does immunity last? Now, in the past, we have heard from doctors on this program, 3 to 4 months, but I also know that we are in a constant state of movement about the variants, about how infectious they are, et cetera. So our best knowledge now, how long do you get extra immunity from having had COVID?
Well, what I do tell patients, you know, the data is still 90 days. We're still sticking with that until we have some updated information. And this becomes really important, especially to patients who choose not to get vaccinated. You know, they think, oh, I've had COVID, so there's no need for me to even worry about getting vaccinated or getting boosters. But I remind them that, you know, after 90 days, you are still vulnerable to getting COVID again. And what we have found is that when you're vaccinated and boosted, your immunity is much longer. So definitely strongly recommend that people do get their vaccines and get boosted, especially after they've had COVID.
So a clarifying question based on what you just said. You said 90 days, but then you said if you're vaccinated and boosted, it lasts longer. I just want to understand, do you say that the extra protection from having been infected lasts longer, or just you're immune better for longer because you've been vaccinated and boosted? Do you understand my question?
Yes, that wasn't very clear. I would say because you're vaccinated and boosted, your immune system lasts much longer. I was really addressing people who have COVID without being vaccinated, that their immune system usually is 90 days, and then they're susceptible to getting COVID again.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Bruno Murtha, as we get ready to wrap here, lots of people will want to gather this weekend. What is your advice? What's the level of safety practice that you recommend in the moment that we're in now?
So for most of the counties in our state of Massachusetts, we are in the high level of COVID in our communities. And as a result, CDC recommends, and I concur with this, that if you are gathering indoors, you should really be wearing a mask. So I would suggest outdoor gatherings, and if there's going to be large crowds in close outdoor settings, and if particularly if somebody is vulnerable, you may want to encourage testing of your guests and participants as another measure to prevent the potential for getting COVID.
All right. That is Dr. Luann Bruno Murtha, who's chief of the Infectious Disease Division at Cambridge Health Alliance, and Dr. Simone Wilds, infectious disease physician at South Shore Health. You've both been very helpful. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So there's this research approach in science called community science. Sometimes it's called citizen science. And it's where everyday people send in data or information to help scientists answer big questions, especially because you can get a lot more numbers of input that way. Well, here in Massachusetts, we have a team of canine citizen scientists. The dogs are not actually doing, you know, the research themselves, but their DNA is helping researchers at MIT, Harvard, UMass Medical School solve some real mysteries about dog personality and dog breed. And this came from a hunt to crowdsource information that could help us better treat human diseases too, which I just find fascinating. I mean, we've talked on this show before about the special relationship between canines and humans and our puppy companions, but this takes it to a whole new level. So we're looking forward to talking about it. First up, Eleanor Carlson. She is the founder and chief scientist of Darwin's Ark, which is a collaborative science project from Harvard, MIT, and the UMass Chan Medical School. Eleanor, welcome.
Thank you.
All right. First, Darwin's Ark it's not like the such and such labs. That's a pretty specific name. You got to start there. Why is it called Darwin's Ark?
So we actually started by calling it Darwin's Dogs because we study evolution, and so Darwin seemed relevant, and we were studying dogs. But actually, a couple of years in, I decided that even though we couldn't do cats yet, that I wanted to make sure we had species flexibility. And so that's when we came up with the name Darwin's Ark.
So it really is the combination of evolution and the Bible, basically.
Well, it was the idea that we wanted to be able to include all of the animals.
Fantastic.
We didn't want to restrict ourselves to just dogs because there's a lot of different species out there that people have close relationships with.
Okay, but for now, you are restricted to dogs. And explain to us, what are you doing with our little canine scientists?
Yeah, so it turns out that dogs get a lot of what we tend to call them in dogs behavioral disorders. So they get something called compulsive disorder. And we'd been studying that for years. And we kind of got stuck because we didn't have enough dogs signed up for our project.
So I'm going to time out there. Just explain what compulsive disorder is for folks.
Yeah, so compulsive disorder is basically, we think it's sort of similar to human OCD. So it's basically when the dogs are doing a behavior that would be otherwise normal, like chasing their tails, but they're doing it so much, you know, hours and hours a day, that it kind of disrupts their quality of life. And they tend to get treated with the same drugs that we use in people that have OCD. And the drugs actually don't work particularly well in dogs or in people. And there's a real need to understand the causes of diseases like OCD if we're going to develop better therapies for people.
So you look at it in dogs, but you don't have a big enough number.
Yeah, we were studying it in Doberman Pinschers, who had this weird behavior that they called flank sucking, which is basically where they chew on themselves. And we did a small study with about 200 dogs, and we found one gene, and it was really interesting. But then we kind of got stuck because we couldn't find more dogs to enroll. But I was talking to somebody about my research one day, and I realized that every time I tell anybody that I work on dog genomics, the first thing that they do if they own a dog is pull out their phone and tell me all about them and show me a picture. And I realized that this was actually an opportunity to get many, many, many dogs signed up for our project and find out all about them. Because, you know, the really unique thing about pets and dogs especially is that people know so much about their own dogs.
I know way too much about my dogs. All right, so enter our next guest. So Margie Alonzo is also in the studio here with us. Margie is executive director of the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants Foundation and an expert in dog behavior. So welcome to you too, Margie.
Thank you.
So we're going to start with your pooch, who then you enrolled in Darwin's Ark, right?
I did, because Eleanor made me. Yes, Nellie's a beagle, although I'm... as I've said before.
We confirmed she's definitely a beagle.
She thinks she's a beagle. She's not. I mean, beagles, I think beagles are not dogs. I think beagles are part dog, part cat, part raccoon, and part goat. But this has not been proven by science yet. We're waiting.
So you enroll Nellie, and what kinds of information does Nellie provide to the...
She's a beagle.
Yeah.
That's 100%.
All right.
She's super beagle-y.
And that's what's the other space that's interesting here. And I do want to flag for listeners, our Radio Boston, at Radio Boston Twitter account has a picture of Nellie in front of a flower that is very boopable. So if you are that kind of Twitter follower, you should go take a look. So part of what happens then is we discover through this research, you've got what, 18,000 dogs that you've profiled in some way or another?
Yeah, so in the paper we published, we had 18,000 dogs. We've talked about the project an awful lot since then, and it turns out we now have, I think, over 38,000 dogs signed up for the project. It's pretty fantastic.
And a lot of them Massachusetts dogs.
Yes.
Okay. So, Margie, you hinted at what is some of the other thing that we're finding, which is it turns out we have a lot of stereotypes about dogs. You know, beagles howl and eat a lot of trash, like you said, part raccoon and part goat, right? We have all these stereotypes, and it turns out not so much.
So it's a really complicated question, but dogs, I think, and Eleanor, correct me if I say this incorrectly, but the sort of the behavior the spectrum of behaviors within a breed are only slightly different than the spectrum of behaviors within all dogs, so that dogs don't act differently than breeds very much. Now, certainly, there are some behaviors, mostly to do with the predatory sequence, that are very specific to some breeds. Border collies are better at herding than beagles. In fact, you should really not get a beagle to herd if you really need a herder. But there may be a beagle that's great at herding somewhere out there.
All right.
It's
so
possible.
To start here, as we enter into this dog behavior stage, I want to play a little bit of a lightning round. So I'm going to give a dog breed, and the two of you are just going to blurt out the stereotype for that dog.
You're going to be
breed.
Much better at this than I am.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. All right. So, ready? So Margie, we expect you to kind of win on this. Ready?
Already won.
Pit bulls.
Two stereotypes on this, actually. One stereotype is that they're vicious and aggressive, and the other is that they are always sweet and kissy.
So, and those are both stereotypes.
They're both stereotypes.
German shepherds. Oh, come on, Eleanor, you can do this one.
Yeah,
two stereotypes. One is that they are always going to protect you and be loyal, and the other is that they are vicious and aggressive.
See, I would have thought the stereotype with German Shepherd was just wicked smart, that they're really smart
Three
dogs.
Stereotypes.
And the interesting thing about these stereotypes is they tend to vary between countries and things like that, too.
Well, yeah.
Different people believe different things about the breeds, but they all believe them quite strongly.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do one more because I have a...
So maybe we're all losing in this because
that's right.
One of the stereotypes is that they are very convenient.
So, okay. All right. So let's just do one more Yorkie because I have a Yorkie. at home. I have two dogs.
Adorable or bitey?
Okay. Bossy was the one I would have come in. But that might be based on
maybe
personal
that's adorable
experience.
And bitey.
So here's what we learned then, Eleanor. As you look across this, and I want to, it took me a couple of times to figure out a way to explain this that kept it simple. There are things that may have, because of the Darwin side of things, may have evolved some in a breed. But just because it's evolved in a breed doesn't mean your dog of that breed will have that behavior. And in fact, your dog of that breed might have some wildly different behavior.
Exactly. I think the question of whether it evolved in the breed is a little bit weird, but I won't get into the complexities of that right now. I will say that when we asked owners about their dogs, they basically reported within every breed kind of everything across the spectrum of the behaviors that we were asking about. And this was a little counterintuitive until you talk to people, you know, that have not owned just one Yorkie, but have owned five different Yorkies across the years. And they will tell you all the ways in which their Yorkies were different from one another. And so it kind of makes sense once you think about it that way. But that it kind of goes against this idea that if you adopt a dog of a particular breed, you're going to know for sure what kind of personality you're going to get.
And that's a problem, Margie, because as somebody who trains dogs and works with families who get dogs, people kind of bank on these stereotypes as they are making choices, whether it's a rescue dog or a purchase of a breed, as they make choices about how to bring a dog into their home.
I think if we look at breed descriptions, it would make gain a little clarity here about where the problems lie. So if we look at a dog that is supposed to be good with children, air quotes, that don't work very well on the radio, you know, dogs within that given breed might often be great with kids, but some won't be. And so then a family might go and get a dog of that breed because they're supposed to be great with kids. And then that dog either wants nothing to do with kids or that dog's great with one kid, but put them in a family with five kids and not so much, you know, and things happen. And so I think it's so important that we look at the dog in front of us and not at the mythology around what a dog is supposed to be according to a breed description. And so, you know, mythology may be a better use of the word than stereotype, right? Because we really do have Rin Tin Tin is saving people and Lassie is, you know, constantly
going home and getting
idiot.
Someone.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
That kid is just not learning. And you know, and all of these things are happening. But in fact, you know, for every collie saving Timmy, there's another one pushing Timmy in the well.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Possibly. I don't know. But there's a malevolent collie out there somewhere, you know, and I'm not sure that that's really a bad collie. It's just that it's just a dog.
Yeah.
And so we have this mythology around breeds, and we are very, very tied to those. And people get really upset when we challenge that. And then they tend to sort of say, oh, go ahead. You know, I mean, I think, you know, one of the problems with this paper was that people are saying, this is nonsense. Go ahead, you know. And now people are going to want to adopt a Malinois for infants or something like that. It's like, no. I mean, maybe, but that would be pretty silly, right?
And Malinois are big, strong dogs. That we at least
know. They're very, what's the word? Eleanor and I occasionally have large arguments over sushi, and they're very productive.
Yeah. Go ahead, Eleanor.
My role in dog research is always a bit strange because, so I've never actually owned a dog, and I only started learning about dogs as a graduate student when I got pulled into dog genomics.
Yeah, you got to fix that.
Yeah, so I'm really kind of weak when it comes to actually each dog breed and what it's supposed to be like.
Drivey. Can we just say drivey?
Okay.
Which
yeah.
Labeling is a terrible thing. It really is. But these are high-energy dogs that are better suited for jumping into, you know, through a closed window in a car and pulling out the bad guy than maybe pushing a baby carriage. But they could do that, too.
All right, so let me come back to you for a minute, Eleanor. So the big aha moment in the research for you, and what are you doing with that aha moment now?
So I think the really fantastic thing about what we did was that we basically went out and said any dog can sign up for our project. We don't care what breed it is. We don't care if it's a mixed breed. We don't care if you have absolutely no idea where your dog came from. And that was different from a lot of the ways that they'd done dog genetics in the past where they were really focused on the breeds. And it turns out that those mixed breed dogs, dogs that have ancestry from many different breeds, are probably going to be particularly powerful for studying genetics.
Why?
Because they kind
that
of,
is fascinating.
Yeah, so they kind of take what's in the different breeds, but then they mix it all up. And so you can kind of look at them and figure out. So we had this worry when we went in. We had a whole lot of surveys and we asked people about their dogs. And we were sort of worried that, you know, people would tell us, give us answers to the surveys based on what they'd been told about the breeds. If they had a purebred dog, you know, labs are good with kids. And so they were going to tell us that labs are good with kids because they'd heard that, not because it was about their own dog. But in the mutts, they've mixed up all the ancestry and you can't actually tell what breeds are in there. So there's no bias. And we can actually pick out things like dogs that have more ancestry from beagles. So say they're 40% beagle as opposed to 10% beagle are more likely to be howling, you know.
Shocking.
And so this is not a surprise to her at all. Also bloodhounds. I was very reassured when I found this. I would have been weird if we hadn't found it. But it just kind of points to that idea that we can actually get at the genetics a bit in the mutts in a way that we couldn't when we were just looking at the purebred dogs.
All right. So one more question to you before I go back to Margie. Did it turn out that between the mutts and the purebred dogs, are there some dominant breeds from the pool here in Massachusetts or the regional pool that you're getting?
Yeah, so if you take all of the dogs in the U.S. or all of the dogs in New England and put them all into a bucket and mix them all up, definitely don't do this. Overall, there's about 17% of the DNA that's in there. Is it 17%? It might have been, no, sorry, 13% of the DNA that was in there would actually be of American Pit Bull Terrier ancestry. So that's the most prevalent breed
percentage.
Ancestry. I think after that was Labrador Retriever. And I can't remember which one came after that. But yeah, so the most common one is that American Pit Bull Terrier
ancestry.
And
of course, I would have guessed some kind of doodle, right?
There's
although, wait.
We did notice that there were a lot of dogs out there that were 50% poodle.
All right, so Margie, let me come back to you. For those who are listening who are now deeply discouraged because they now have no idea if they're going to get a dog, how they could possibly tell what kind of animal it's going to be for them, what are some things that people can reliably check for or look for in getting a dog based on what we've now learned from this research study here in the Commonwealth?
Dogs are not a commodity. Dogs are a member of the family. So the first thing I would suggest is make a list of what your expectations are. If you don't go for walks very often, but you're getting a dog because you're pretty sure you want to summit mountains, and you're just going to do that if you get a dog, you know, I agree. You might go for more walks with a dog, but maybe you don't get a dog that has to go for 20-mile walks every day. Make a list of what you want and what your expectations and hopes are. And then find, first of all, at the size and shape of a dog. As Eleanor has said before, if you put together all the dogs that run fast and keep breeding them, eventually it's going to look like a greyhound, right?
Got it.
So a Yorkie might not be the best hiking companion, but a
they
bigger
are
dog,
not.
Yeah,
it's good to know.
They don't have knees,
right.
So the first thing is find out what you want with this dog, and a fantasy of what a dog is important. I don't mean that in a derogatory way. It matters what you want with this dog. And if you want a dog for the kids, you're getting another kid. You know, it's not going to be the kid's dog. It's going to be your dog. And then accept that dog for who they are, just like you would accept any child you had, if you have kids, for who they are. And, you know, we expect dogs to learn everything in 6 weeks of class that we sort of pay attention to. But how you train, we call it training for dogs and teaching for kids. That's wrong. So teach your dog to be the dog you want and make expectations happen.
All right. That was Margie Alonzo, who is the executive director of the International Association of Animal Behavior Consultants Foundation, and Eleanor Carlson, the researcher from Darwin's Ark, founder and lead scientist there. We learned a lot today. Thanks to both of you. It is in the 70s. It is starting to feel glorious, although we're not quite to summer. But you will know that we're headed there from the iconic scent of barbecue all over your neighborhood, the streets of Boston, wherever you are this weekend. It is Memorial Day coming up, and it's an important holiday. It's a serious holiday, but it's also a weekend when people get together. They join as family, they celebrate, they observe the moment, and they prepare for summer. Ron Swanson from NBC's show Parks and Recreation has some very strong thoughts on what food should be served at such gatherings.
Barbecues should be about one thing, good shared meat.
Pretty straightforward there. And we're going to talk about that. And we're also going to dive into what exactly is a barbecue. Is that a generic term? Is that a specific term? What should you put on your grill this weekend? Can a veggie make it? Many questions. We have so many questions. And joining us now in studio, Chef Joe Gatto, who is the host of From Scratch and has been with us regularly over the last couple of years. But it's been COVID, so it's so great to see you here in studio, too.
Woohoo!
I know, hello.
I mean, is this awesome or what? We're actually looking at each other.
I know. And
this is fantastic.
And I want to let listeners in on a little secret, because not only are we looking at each other, but I am wildly distracted because it is 11:45. I am hungry, and you brought sliders, which are sitting on a plate in front of us, and we're not going to eat them for a few minutes, and it is torture.
Awesome.
That they're sitting here.
That was the whole idea.
That's right.
I wanted to torture you the entire interview.
That's right. So I want to back up a little bit and ask you, you're a family guy. Everything about how you cook, how you teach people to cook seems so rooted in family. Did you cook out a lot as a kid?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we couldn't wait. And my big thing was I always helped my mom. So it was always me and my mom in the kitchen preparing the steak teriyaki or just even like decorating the backyard. It was always such an event. And I looked forward to those so much, seeing all my cousins, and my Uncle Al would be flipping burgers, like, and he made the best burger. He'd grind everything himself. So I have these really strong memories. And now, you know, we recreate them at my house, and my kids jump in and they help, and they have their friends over, and people are running around and stuff in their face. That's like my favorite thing in the world, is to feed people and just have everyone enjoy it and be together.
And what for you, from your childhood, looking back, what was the most iconic outdoor cookout food?
Oh, you're looking at it.
Oh, dude, it's the slider, the burger.
Oh,
here?
Yeah, you make your own grind. You know, like you, when we do parties, you know, I'll make my own cheese. I'll make the rolls. Like, I'll go. That, to me, is the quintessential food. And I love it as a slider, as opposed to like a big burger. Because I always found that burgers, you always see half-eaten burgers left over at a party, but sliders, you never see left over.
So what constitutes a slider? How do we tell the difference between a slider and a burger?
I mean, it's like a 3-ounce patty on a small
bun. Well, wait a minute. What's a burger then?
Like, those are usually 4 or 5. You know, those are getting bigger.
It's not like
18 ounces. No. I mean, you can do a Beast Burger, you know, and just watch people struggle and laugh. I mean, I have no problem with that. You know, you can get 6, 8-ounce burgers. Mm-hmm. It really depends on what you're doing. I like the little guys, especially because I do them on this piece of equipment I have called a baking steel.
Mm-hmm. What is that?
It's my friend Andrus's company. And it's designed for pizzas, so it's a piece of steel that goes onto your grill or in your oven, wherever you put it. And you can get that temperature up 600-700 degrees. And when you're caramelizing—
Because the steel heats
right,
up.
Right, and the steel retains that heat, as opposed to like a stone. When you slide on a pizza, the stone's going to drop temperature, and you're not going to get that beautiful leoparding on the bottom of your pizza, as opposed to a piece of steel that keeps that temperature so you get that beautiful crispy crust all leoparded on the bottom of pizza. But if you put it on your grill and crank it and do sliders or steaks, I smash mine. Mm-hmm. Like an old school kind of like diner.
Like hammer?
Yeah. I'm just wailing away on them. Like a big spatula.
Okay.
And you squish them down just as you put them on, not after, mm-hmm. just as you put them on. So what it does is it gives it tons of surface area to caramelize. And we know caramelization is the key. Get that nice brown crust, bring the sugars to the surface, getting that yumminess that we're looking for. And then you flip them, and like these right here, little caramelized onion, a little American cheese.
Nice,
yes,
nice.
American cheese, because it rocks on a slider. And then a nice fluffy bun. And to me, that and like a beer, I mean, I'm there all day.
Fantastic. All right, so we're going to try these here. I'm
okay.
Gonna move away from the mic for a minute so I can get mine off my plate. You can get yours,
yep,
too.
Yep, you go first.
Okay. I'm pretty excited I get to go first. All right, so I'm going to take a bite. And while I take a bite, you're going to say, you said a minute ago you will make your own cheese. You make your own American cheese?
Oh, yeah, there's tons of ways to make all different kinds of cheese. I mean, one of the cheeses that we love to do is mozzarella, which is...
Oh, God, this is so good. Sorry, go ahead.
See, these are the moments that I love. Mm-hmm. This is why I do what I do. And like tonight, I'm teaching a big pizza class, and we're going to make mozzarella because it's not that hard. You know, we're taking curd, we're using salted hot water, and we're pulling it. And you get this velvety, gorgeous cheese. When you're making cheese at home, it's an adventure, and it's fun, and you can customize it.
So what constitutes American cheese?
American cheese is really Colby.
Oh,
and
okay.
So you can melt that down and use a gelatin and then add in like smoked Gouda, mm-hmm. and melt that down. And what you'll get is something you can spread on like a sheet pan with parchment. You spread it out super thin, let it set, and then you have smoked Gouda American cheese, and you can cut it into slices and use that.
Holy shit.
So, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean,
sounds really good.
Yeah, it's punch yourself in the face good.
Yes.
You know, like, it's ridiculous. So I'm going to try a bite and see how I did.
You take a bite. This is delicious. So just for folks, they're kind of small square. There's a little bit of a little pickle on there, some cheese. It is a no-nonsense, unfancy, absolutely fabulous miniature burger.
Mm.
And actually, you know, these have been sitting in here for a while, so they're a little cold, and they still taste fantastic. So is this a pickle?
Yeah, it's a homemade pickle. It actually came from my wife and I had a little date night on last Saturday just mm-hmm. at the house. You know, why go out? We have me.
Yeah.
And one of her favorite things, and she asked for it, was chicken satay.
Mm-hmm.
So I made a chicken satay, and there's a thing called a jod, which is like a pickled vegetable that goes over the top. So you get that brightness with that richness of the peanut sauce. It just plays, you know, every dish should just have balance, like relationships, like life. Balance is the most important thing. And I had the ajad, which is perfect little pickled vegetable. So that cuts through that nice beefiness
yep.
and brightens it up a bit. And that really helps you because you have rich onions, rich beef, the cheese, which should be creamy, and then that brightness just hits you. So you end up eating like four or five of them,
right?
And it's not a bad deal.
So the team is very excited about the pickle factor here. So we have a couple follow-up questions on the pickle for you. And, of course, I'm going to eat another bite while
of
you
course.
To them. So the two questions – well, one is a comment. Marquise in the control room said that he could feel the love in the pickle. So a nod to you.
Oh, come on.
You could taste the love in the pickle. and so the question is dill versus bread and butter pickle.
I mean, I always think that's a choice. Like, and for me, when I'm pickling, it's really like, how's my day going? Yeah. Do I feel sweet? Do I feel a little spicy? Because if I'm feeling spicy, I might throw some jalapenos in there.
Ooh.
Right? And like, you can pickle like all different. We pickle carrots, we pickle peppers, we pickle onions. Onions is a big thing we pickle a lot at the house because we do a lot of authentic Mexican. And mm-hmm. that, again, those deep, earthy flavors with that brightness. That's what gives your mouth that, like, dance,
that full
you know?
Yeah,
it's like not just one note. You can't stop getting a bite. And then if you add a little spice in there, your mouth's just totally like, this is exactly what I needed right now.
Okay, so we're going to hit the grill now for a little while, and we're going to do a quick lightning round first.
Okay.
All right. For a beginner, best meat to cook on the grill?
I would say if you're doing, like, ribeyes or New York strips.
Those steak.
Those are really easy to do. They're all about high temp. One of the things that when I teach a steakhouse class, which, you know, I do at a lot of the like resident hotels in the seaport, I work with a lot of them and they always reach out to me to do classes. So one of them I love to do is because they have these big grills for their parties out there and no one uses them. So the whole idea is you have to heat that grill up for at least 10 minutes.
Okay. So you got to get good and hot.
You got to get it super hot, right? And you want your steak out of the fridge for 20 minutes, a half hour. You want it rested. You want it to salt before you're putting it on. You don't just salt and then put it on because the salt's going to fall off. But you also want to salt it because it's almost like it's going to go all the way through osmosis. It's going to get deep into that and really give you a beautiful, like, yummy crust. So I would say,
so
like,
steak.
Yeah, steak's a great one. Chicken's really easy on the grill. You know,
no, it's not.
Oh, come on.
No, chicken is not easy on the grill. You can't tell if it's I mean, I like chicken on the
grill. Right.
You can't tell if it's cooked. You don't know how long it's going to take. You can never get enough seasoning in there, so it's not a little bit bland.
Oh, yeah. Brine your chicken.
Okay.
Always brine your chicken, even if it's just simple salt,
what does it mean to
sugar.
Brine? There we go.
Yeah, it's salt. It's a salt base. And what it does, what a brine does is it's basically a salt solution that will penetrate all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like a marinade that's acid-based.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to penetrate all the way through and through osmosis because it's semi-permeable cell walls down there. It's going to take the water out, and it's going to replace it with your flavored water. So if you add a little lemon and a little garlic, you're going to get...
It's going to soak in.
Yeah, and if you're trying to cook chicken, one of the things I've taught people over the years, works with steak as well, is take a thermometer, like a digital thermometer, stick it in the side, not at the top, so you see the temperature of the chicken. You're going to pull, I like to pull it at like 158, so it has, you know, continuation
cooking.
So we'll
continue to cook
right,
after
so 155, 158. And then when you pull it out, poke it, because mm-hmm. you know it's the right temperature.
Okay.
Poke it. Do that every time
mm-hmm.
for, I don't know, 10 or 12 times, however many times you cook chicken.
Yep.
And then guess what? Next time it's on the
You'll
the
be
grill?
Able to tell.
Right.
Perfect. Okay, so now I want to move into vegetables. And what I want you to do is give me a menu I could serve that includes cooking something on an open flame that has no meat in it.
Okay, here we go. All right.
Let's do this.
Just did this Saturday night.
Good.
My wife loves vegetables, doesn't eat meat really. So I made black bean burgers.
Okay.
Super easy, right? Black bean, you can kind of add whatever you want. But
what did you add?
I did black beans, and then I did a little cheese. I did a little, like, I took tomatoes mm-hmm. and food processed that with a little Italian seasoning. Mm. Like, it was really unctuous and just yummy. And you cook it just like a burger because you add a little breadcrumb, and you can make that gluten-free, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you flour it or anything. And I do that right on the baking steel.
Okay.
And if don't do it on the grill grates.
Put it on some kind of sheet.
Right. So, or if you have, you know, a cast iron, put it right on the grill.
Okay.
And instead of buns, because she doesn't really do gluten, I did portobello mushrooms.
Excellent.
That I had marinated in lemon and garlic overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And then I dried them off really well, and I seared those right
like
on the baking steel. Exactly. Just like a whole cap.
Yeah.
And those were the buns.
Great. And what'd you serve as a side?
So we didn't do a side because we had done the satay, but one of the side dishes that I love to do that, because people always put salads out, which never seem to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. They're just kind of sitting there and everyone's like, nah, I'm going to pass. But one of the things we do, and I do it for parties at home, is a grilled roasted vegetable salad.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
So you do peppers, onions, asparagus, Brussels, right? And you toss them in a little olive oil, salt, pepper, garlic, everything you want. And then you roast them all on the grill. So you get that beautiful char. You put them all in a big bowl, toss it with like a lemon, garlic, vinaigrette, any kind of vinaigrette you want. So it's bright. Serve that. It will be gone.
All right.
Party will be a rock star hit.
I would eat all of that.
Yes.
That sounds really good.
That's exactly what happens. It's super good.
All right. In our last half a minute or so, what about people who they live in an apartment, they can't get to a park where there might be a public grill? How do you create that cookout vibe? That way.
Yeah, I mean, when you're stuck inside, one of the big things is you still have flame. You still have a broiler, which is like an upside-down grill. You still have an oven, and you still have burners. So you can't smoke a brisket. But you could take that pork shoulder, right, do it in a slow cooker, and then finish it on the stovetop by searing it. Like, once you pull it, you sear it in a little, like, nonstick, and you get that crunchiness. So you can really create these things in slow cookers in your oven. You know, it's really easy to plan for. You just have to figure out, you don't go into it last minute saying, I want to make a brisket and I'm stuck indoors.
Right.
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 You know, you think it through. You make a chicken dish and then, you know, you rock and roll and, you know, always make friends with people that have smokers.
There you go. Hey, it is so great to have you. That is Joe Gatto, chef and host of From Scratch. Appreciate you being here.
I love being here. So good seeing you.
You too. And the slider was delicious. Really
Thank
loved
you.
It. And that's it. That is the show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. My tummy is happy. I'm glad you listened. Why don't you tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston?